on to part three. Yesterday we said that the sole purpose of creation is loving kindness, and therefore if judgment or strict justice exist at all, they exist only as a way of implementing loving kindness, and therefore even when justice requires pain, suffering, it's done in a manner to communicate that it's not meant viciously or cruelly, and also sometimes it's simply suspended. These are, so to speak, rules by which God runs the world. Then he goes on to say that God gave man free will, and that he set up a system of reward and punishment, which would be based fairly on the actions that the person performs. Which means, as I have said to you a number of times, that in this aspect of God's activity, he's reactive. We make choices, and he reacts to those choices. He, the word here is up there, subjugated his providence to our actions. Intuitively, you think of the creator, the all-powerful, infinite creator of the universe, as totally independent, totally self-sufficient. It's abstractly and philosophically, it's a little surprising that he would set things up so that what he does depends upon what we do. That he would react to us. I mentioned to some of you the analogy, if you have a dream, and imagine you're having a dream, and this dream, things are happening, you're walking, there are other people, talking to them, interacting with them, and one of the people in the dream says to you, "Promise me that you'll X." And in the dream you say, "Yes, I promise that I'll X." Now you wake up. Are you bound by the promise? What promise? I mean, it was just a dream. There wasn't anybody else there. The experience of the dream was based on transactions in my brain. I didn't promise to anybody. There's nobody there. Now, in a roughly similar way, vis-a-vis God, we are here. We're just his creatures. He keeps creating us all the time by giving us existence. Just like the transactions in my brain keep creating that dream figure all the time. When the transaction stops, it disappears. How could God have a real relationship with something which for him is a dream figure? So obviously the analogy can't be 100% exact, but it's something like that, where our existence isn't anything independent. Is the whole of the creation a game of solitaire? Is God the only player? Because he's propping up everybody else. You know, it's sort of like when you play chess, you know, you play both sides. Make a move for the white, then you go around and make a move for the black, and you come back and make a move for the white. Yeah, but I made the move for the black. I know what his strategy is, and it's all my game. So if we're being sort of propped up by God and kept in existence the whole time, then he talks to us and makes a covenant with us, and we're bound and he's bound, and it's a little bit of a shadow boxing, you know. I mean, who's the other side? Somehow, even though we are totally dependent upon God, our whole existence is propped up by the energy he blows into us continuously, still, he gave us enough reality that we can have a relationship with him. This is really dependent upon free will. A squirrel really can't have a relationship with God. There's nothing there to relate to. A squirrel is just God's creative activity. Nothing else. So it's just more of things that God does. A human being is not only things that God does. A human being is, in part, things that the human being does. And that's why a relationship can be set up. So here he says he subjugates his providence. In other words, he makes his providence dependent upon what we do. He takes a reactive position, which reflects, I'm just cutting it one step deeper, that we have some independent reality of our own. Independent. It's not independent. It's a reality that we can self-create to a certain extent. And that way he can have a real relationship with us, really interact with us, and make his providence dependent upon what we do. Now, having said all that, he then says, maybe I'll translate it. But in truth, in reality, he is not subject to any law. He doesn't need anything outside of himself. He's not affected by anything. And therefore, if he wants to use his... Now, in the Hebrew, the word means height. I would say, in our language, I would say his transcendence. What does he say? He doesn't say anything else. He imposes fear. But he wants to use his... the fact that he's transcendent above, he can act and perform according to his will without any necessity or obstacle, something to hold him back at all. So then he says, there are really two aspects of how God relates to the world. One is Mishpat. Mishpat is where he reacts according to rules. He reacts to us on the basis of what we do. That's Mishpat. And then there's another one, which in the Das Munos, in the Understanding Heart, the book is really about how the two interact with one another, is Hanagas Yichudo, where he brings the creation to its intended purpose independently of the actions of people below. And in others, as far as the way he explains it, is this. Mishpat is reactive. It's reactive according to certain rules. Now, Mishpat is not din. We said yesterday, din is strict justice. You get exactly what you did. A person can perform an action, or a group can perform an action so terrible that in strict justice, they deserve to be annihilated. They don't deserve to exist at all. What will happen if the world as a whole deteriorates to the point where, in terms of strict justice, it deserves annihilation? The answer is that God won't operate with strict justice. Okay, so then you can put in mercy. You go up from din to mishpat. Mishpat meaning judgment, which takes into account more than strict justice, maybe a second chance, maybe an investment in future improvement. Suppose the world deteriorates to such a point that even mercy isn't worthwhile. Then what is going to sustain the world? What's going to sustain the world is an aspect of divine providence that is not reactive. That is not reactive. That is unconditional. That can carry the world no matter what happens down here. Because God is committed to the world, the creation, succeeding at the purpose that he set for it. So there are periods of time in which the world is sustained only because of God's commitment to the ultimate purpose. Not because of anything that's happening below. Let me say a little bit more. Certain principles, by their very nature, need a reason. They can't exist without a reason. Mercy is one of them. If someone says, please be merciful, you can always ask him, why? Give me a reason. Why is that? Why is a plea for mercy dependent upon giving a reason? Because a plea for mercy says, don't do justice. Justice says, such and such should happen, and a plea for mercy says, I know I'm guilty, I know I deserve to be punished, don't punish me anyway. Mercy is always uphill against justice. If somebody says, I know I'm guilty, I know according to the law and according to justice I should be punished, but don't do it anyway. That's astonishing. What do you mean don't do it anyway? You just told me why it should be done. You give me a reason to do it, and then say, don't do it. That's a b'shuftiniya schema. We're talking about insane people here. If you tell me there's a reason to do it, and you want me not to do it, you have to give me a counter reason. The captain reasoned that at least it's good or maybe better than the reason to do it. A plea for mercy always requires a reason. It can't be standing on its own. Might be you yourself are committed to mercy. You're a merciful person, and therefore you should show your mercy under these conditions. Something. But you can't just say, don't do justice. So, on the level of mishpat, on the level of judgment, everything is dependent upon rules and everything depends upon reasons. This higher providence isn't dependent upon reasons at all. It is God's commitment that the world shall come to fulfill its purpose. And that can sustain the world when there are no reasons at all. Yeah.
It seems like mercy is based on an emotion.
No. No, not at all. When you'll examine courtroom procedure, you'll examine actual court cases, and the guy is convicted, and the defense attorney makes a plea for mercy, he doesn't play a violin and start weeping to the judge, you know, please have mercy. No, he says, listen, my client has a good education, and this is his first time offense, and his family will take care of him, and they will pay for his rehabilitation, and he isn't a danger to the community. Those are reasons, that's not emotion. That's reasons why I shouldn't send him to prison. Somebody else who will be convicted or won't have those reasons will go to prison. There's not emotion. And that's the reasons why justice shouldn't be done. So, what we have to understand is that the way God runs the world is on two levels. There's the level of mishpat, which is reactive, and there's a level of the higher providence, which is constant, and the expression of his commitment and nothing else, and cannot be affected by anything that we do. Yeah.
So there's that higher providence, and that includes din?
No.
You said there's mishpat, and then there's a higher providence.
No, there's din and mishpat, which are both part of the reactive.
But din is also reactive.
Sure. Justice, strict justice, is certainly reactive. Right? What you do is what you get. Strict din is the most primitively, directly, exactly reactive. You went through the stop sign, $25. No, that's my time. $150. They raise the prices. You won the jackpot, $3 million. Whatever you did, you get immediately without any other thought. Din, strict justice is, you know, they have a symbol, I think it goes back to Greece. The civil justice is a woman holding scales in her hand, blindfolded. It's a pretty good idea. Justice is blind. You did, you get it. I don't care who you are, where you came from, where you're going, who your connections are, what the consequences are. You get what you did right here and now. I have the scales. If it goes down this way, it goes down that way. That's it. Nothing else to take it into account. That makes justice very, I would say, naive and primitive in a certain way. That's why mishpat is reactive, but takes more things into account. Take your background and your circumstances and the likely consequences for other people and second chance, investing in your future. All those things can be taken into account in mishpat. But it's still reactive. It's reactive to the conditions under which you're operating. So din and mishpat are both reactive. They're just reactive in different ways. Far above that is what's called hanatas hayichud, where he is going to bring the world to its creation, to its end, no matter what happens. You have a question?
Rafael, that is reactive also? You have to give reasons.
Sure, of course it's reactive. Of course it's reactive.
So that's not part of the
that's right. That's not. That's right. That's right. Yeah, as I said, the upper level comes into play when even mercy won't help you. That's exactly why I said it. But even if you even mercy, you don't even deserve mercy. You know, what you've done forfeits your right to continue to exist altogether. But what did God do after the flood? He made a promise that it wouldn't happen again. What wouldn't happen again? There wouldn't be another universal destruction, even if the world deserves it. Otherwise, the promise is empty. If the promise is only, I won't bring a universal destruction as long as you don't deserve it, but if you deserve it, I'll do it again, then there's no promise. No, the promise is, even if you deserve it, I won't do it. Well, what's going to sustain the world that they deserve it? What's going to sustain this world? This higher principle which says the world has to succeed. Yeah?
So until then, they didn't have that higher level of...
Okay, that's a good question. How the higher level expresses itself. Obviously, the whole world didn't cease to exist. So the commitment that the world shall continue was kept at that time. Now that higher level is being extended to cover even that means of kind of having a what they call a bottleneck, you know, where you funnel everybody out and keep a very small group, that even that's not going to be used. It's a question of how that higher level maintains the existence of the world. Yeah.
So it's not exactly true that if people are learning Torah for one moment, then the world's going to cease to exist because there's high levels.
Good point. Good point. I can squeak out of it. I can squeak out of it. Listen, there's a contradiction, a seeming contradiction in the Talmud about under what conditions the Messiah will come. One says the Jewish people have to do the tshuva. They have to repent. Have to improve themselves. Otherwise, he's not coming. The other says he's definitely coming. What do you mean? He's got to come. Period. It's a promise that he's coming. Some reconcile it as follows. There has to be tshuva. It has to happen. The only question is, under what conditions will it happen? When Haman made a decree of annihilation of the entire Jewish people, they did tshuva. Of course, that's a pretty drastic means to get people to do tshuva. But they did it. The Gemara says, greater was King Ahasuerus taking off his ring and giving it to Haman, then all the prophecies of the, what was it, 58 prophets and 7 prophetesses that the Jews had for 1,000 years. Why? Because all the prophets told them to do tshuva and they didn't do it. Ahasuerus took off his king, bang, they did it. So there are different ways to get the Jewish people to do tshuva. And their reconciliation is, it definitely depends upon our doing tshuva. But it will happen anyway, because if necessary, God will cause the tshuva. A low-level tshuva, but a tshuva. So the same thing is true over here. There may be that the world is dependent upon Jews learning Torah. There would be a moment where Jews would not learn Torah. Then the world will cease to exist. That being the case, God will arrange it so that at all moments there are some Jews learning Torah. So it is really the means that keeps the world in existence is learning of Torah. When I say if it would be something impossible, because God won't allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. And actually, without thinking of it, there are ideas like this. The Gaon of Vilna says, you look in the story of the Exodus. At one point, it says that they cried out from the terrible, heavy labor that the Egyptians put on them. Other places, it says, why did God saved them from Egypt because he promised the patriarchs. It was the covenant of the patriarchs, not because they deserved it. So the Gaon of Vilna says like this. God made a covenant with the patriarchs. That's true. But what makes the covenant with the patriarchs relevant to that Jewish generation in Egypt? How are they connected to that covenant? Are they representing that covenant? Are they the continuation of that covenant? There has to be some connection there. So God caused the Egyptians to increase the suffering, to stimulate them to cry out, and through crying out, they were then relevant to covenant and could be saved. Otherwise, you have the alternative that God gave to Moses twice, after the golden calf and after the spies. I'll wipe them all out, then I'll make a nation out of you. So it'll take a couple of centuries. So what? So what? Folks, there's time. So I'll keep my promise to the Jewish people as a whole, meaning through you. It'll be a bottleneck, like the flood. It'll be a bottleneck. And almost everybody gets squeezed out. And then Moses will go through, and then he'll recreate the Jewish people that way. So God used this strategy to avoid that, and to be able to save all of the Jews in Egypt, but he had to stimulate them to become connected to the covenant with the patriarchs. And he did it by causing them to cry out. So the same thing is true with the Mashiach, the same thing is true as there, and the same thing could be true over here as well. Over here, hopefully it doesn't have to be so desperate, you know, I mean, there are a lot of Jews who want to learn Torah. Just give them an opportunity, and you'll have them, I think, doing fine. Yeah.
Isn't that... seems like that disrupts the concept of free will.
Okay, let me... we're going a little aside, but these are very important points. Disrupts the concept of free will. Let me ask you about the following example. George is on the way to the ice cream store. The ice cream store sells vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry. George's preferences for ice cream are vanilla first, chocolate second, and strawberry third. And he's going to this ice cream store. We all know what he's going to do. He's going to buy vanilla. Now, I want him to buy chocolate. That's what I want. He wants to buy vanilla. I have two options. I can take out my trusted revolver and put it to his head and say, George, chocolate this time. See? That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is this. I can race to the ice cream store before he gets there and buy up all the vanilla. Now George comes in and he says, give me a quart of vanilla. The guy says, you know, some nut just walked in here and bought up all the vanilla. You know, 65 quarts of vanilla. He bought it all. You know, even Haagen-Dazs. And the whole thing, it's gone. But I have chocolate and strawberry. Now George says, where's my vanilla? Okay, but you have chocolate and strawberry? I'll take chocolate. Is that a free choice? Of course it's a free choice. He had two choices and he picked the one that he wanted. Had there been vanilla, it'd be three. One out of three, one out of two are both free choices. But I manipulated it so that he chose what I wanted him to choose. Now God has a lot of leeway. He has a lot of leeway to manipulate circumstances so that he structures the choices in such a way that you freely choose what he wants you to choose. It's not 100% leeway, but it's a lot of leeway. So when we take that into account, you see that God can affect choices, you know. God could create a situation in which people are paid to learn Torah. That actually exists, by the way. There's a program now on various college campuses where people are, in particular non-religious Jews, are paid to come to a weekly chavrusa. I don't know if they're paid for a week, and then, you know, they just come to pay there, and they show up for the money. But that's fine. That's the only way to get them there. Get them there for the money. Right? So, and that's certainly free will. They're choosing to do something for the money. A person takes a job, it's free will. So God, by structuring the choices, can enable the outcome to be what he wants, even without taking away free will, under many, many circumstances. Not always, but many circumstances. All right, are we all together? Okay. Now, I'm going to tell you something that he says towards the end of the chapter that I don't understand. I'll just share it with you. It's a fascinating idea. He says that if you think about the growth of a human being, stages, childhood, and then reaching maturity, and then reaching his full powers, and then decline. And if you think about the history of mankind, you'll see a parallel. The first state of human of mankind was the period of time when the knowledge of God was obscured, the Torah was not yet given. There was a very, very, very tiny sprinkling of people who knew the truth and were exalted people, but the vast majority of mankind was empty, like early childhood, where the child has no idea of right and wrong, or good and evil, has no high values or goals. Ignorance. The second state, which in the human being would be, I guess, early maturity, in Torah terms, early teens, middle teens, is somewhat better. There's knowledge of the existing perfection of God. His Torah is available, and we can serve him. But there is no sign and no prophet. Holy Spirit is missing. And although you can gain knowledge, you have to work hard to get it. It's an immature state. Okay? In human beings' development, that's stage two. In historical development, he says, that's now. We have the Torah. And we do know of God's existence and his perfection, though we have no prophecy, no Holy Spirit, no inspiration. And we struggle. We struggle in the darkness and, you know, try to attain what knowledge we can. Now notice that what stage two in human beings' development is the last is skipping over a middle stage in human historical development. The third state, which is full maturity for human being, full strength, is the period of the Holy Temple. Prophets, miracles, But I made a mistake before. I said decline. That was a mistake. But still, prophecy only limited to the Jewish people, and miracles only in a very small locus in the temple and other areas where it was important for Jewish history. The fourth state is the very best. This is the height of a person's life. And that's for the ultimate future, when Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, will be poured out on all mankind. Not only Jews. All mankind. And the knowledge of God will be attained with any, without any difficulty whatsoever. Now, the problem here is that the stages aren't in order. The stages of human being are 1, 2, 3, 4, and the stages in human development, in human history, are 1, 3, 2, 4. I just don't get it. I don't understand why that should be. It's very peculiar, especially since he's making the parallel. He himself is making the parallel, but the stages are out of order. Maybe it shouldn't have been that way. Maybe that's the answer. Shouldn't have been that way. In fact, there probably shouldn't have been four stages. There probably should have been three stages. Maybe that's the answer. I have to think about it. Maybe that's the idea. Boy, is it worthwhile to teach? I've been thinking about this problem for a lot of years. That must be it. It's out of order only because we failed. Had we succeeded, we would have gone from receiving the Torah to coming into the land of Israel, to building the temple, and to having an influence on all mankind, to bringing all mankind to the truth, and then going straight into what we call the Messianic era. Through waiting for David and Solomon. Solomon could have been the Mashiach. It could have happened then.
That's four.
What?
It is four.
What?
No. What's the key name again?
Yeah, this way it'll be the 2,000 years before the Torah is given. That's like early childhood with no knowledge at all. Then there is the giving of the Torah, the election of the Jewish people, prophecy among them alone, and miracles that happen to them alone. That's what you're behind mankind not involved. And then, through living the Torah appropriately, attracting mankind and elevating them to the point where it will be the Messianic era. What skipped out is our stage of exile, where things have gone down and been reduced again. Oh, that's got to be the answer. Wow. Well, that's almost done. I got that. Good. Terrific. Fine. Now,
really?
On to the next. Part 3. The soul, the holy inspiration, the prophecy. A lot of things in here that I'm not going to be able to do, but important things we'll try to do. He starts off by reminding us that man is different from all the other creations. Man is composed of two elements, the soul and the body. Really, the word soul can be used in about 17 different ways and has 17 different references, and you have to sort them out carefully. He says that, and by the way, the word for soul here is nefesh, not neshama, which is related to breath, but nefesh. It really isn't related to anything. And he says that animals have nefesh also. Nefesh is, one aspect of nefesh is that which produces animal life, as opposed to plants, which don't have nefesh. Animal life is produced by nefesh, which means that a human being has nefesh also. Because the human body is an animal body, so to speak. And therefore has an nefesh which keeps it in existence. It is this animal soul, that he says, that is responsible for natural feelings and intelligence. Intelligence. And he says this type of soul also exists in all living creatures. Yeah, but those living creatures, these animals. transmitted through the genetic material, as he says. And it spreads to organize the body and its activities as appropriately for each creature. And therefore, he says, animals have intelligence. He says it explicitly. Now, this ought to be obvious, and you'll ask people who aren't connected with religious thought, religious ideas, it is obvious. It's important to notice that our sources recognize it as well. Animals have intelligence. Animals can solve problems. Problems which they have not been simply trained by rote to solve. Rats learn how to solve mazes simply by placing, you get to the food, you don't get to the food, and after a while, they learn them. Dogs solve primitive problems. Chimpanzees can solve quite complicated problems. So there's no question that animals have intelligence, and therefore that intelligence in man is part of that nefesh which is related to his body. Just as the nefesh of animals is related to their body. However, he says, in man's so-called animal soul, there are other faculties, other abilities. They include imagination, memory, intelligence, and will. That's really quite a lot. Imagination, memory, intelligence, and will. Now, there's an interesting question here. I can't find a proof how the Ramchal holds one way or the other on this, but I'll just tell you what the question of Maimonides in his introduction to the chapters of the Fathers, the Ethics of the Fathers, asks. Should we say, and the Ramban discusses this in his Bereshis as well, should we say that man possesses two souls? He's got an animal soul for the body, like a horse does, and like a chimpanzee does, and like a dolphin does. And in addition to that, he has a divine soul, which enables him to do the things that all human beings can do. In other words, according to this idea, you ask, how does man grow? I say, well, take a look at a horse. If you can figure out how a horse grows, you pretty much understand how a man grows. How does a man see? Take a look how an eagle sees. You gotta figure out how an eagle sees. Have a pretty good insight in how a man sees. The principles by which man's body works are body principles, physical principles, strictly on a par with the rest of the animal world. And then in addition, man has a spiritual soul. That's one view. That view Maimonides rejects. Maimonides says that man's divine soul directs everything that he does. A man doesn't grow the way animals grow. He grows because of the influence of his divine soul. And he sees because of the influence of his divine soul. And he walks because of the influence of his divine soul. In man, everything is traced to the higher element. He just says this. He doesn't give any proof for it. As I said to you, there are two ways to look at it. Ramchal is not, as I can tell, he doesn't clearly commit himself in this matter. And I don't know what to say in terms of its.
It seems like he has two, because he says one type of soul that man has.
Yeah, but they're not independent of one another. They're not cut off from one another. They form a kind of unit and interact with one another. The question is, how strong is the interaction? Is it two separate things interacting, or is the lower thing a tool in the hands of the upper thing? That'll be the question, and that the language is not going to do.
Those types of souls exist in all living creatures and they vary ethereally.
Yeah. The question is whether it's just it's talking about the activities now, or the way in which the activities take place. Talking about the causation. Inner causation could still be coming from above. At any rate, now, I want to also just point out, it says will. have to be very careful here. Here I think he's following the language of the Ramban. Animals don't have free will. That shouldn't be a surprise, as we've said over and over again, including about 10 minutes ago. To have free will, you have to be composed of a soul and a body. And they don't have a divine soul. This nefesh that keeps them alive is part of the physical world. As he said, that it's the thinnest, the very top of the physical world. You know, the thing that's the most delicate and least materialized of the physical world. But it's part of the physical world. So animals don't have free will. So when he talks about will, will does not imply free will. Will does not imply free will. Animals take a look around their surroundings, and on the basis of what's going on, they do something. They act, but they don't act freely. That's the picture, that's the vocabulary. So when you see the word ratzon, ratzon meaning will, don't associate it with free will. Free will is not part of the so-called animal soul of man, and it certainly isn't any part of any animal, other animal. So it's got to be the combination of divine soul and the body that gives you the possibility of free will. Yeah.
Could you say about a computer that a computer has ratzon?
Well, let's ask a more primitive question. You know, when the wind blows the pebble off the shelf and it falls onto the floor, shall I say that the pebble has ratzon? Huh? No. So then, where do I draw the line? The pebble is just responding to the natural forces. And the squirrel is responding to the natural forces. And the chimpanzee is responding to the natural forces. So why would I want to say that there's ratzon in the chimpanzee if there isn't in the pebble?
Okay.
I think that ratzon is a word for a certain complexity of response. A response that can take account of the various circumstances that are going on, and is flexible to changes in the circumstances, can be reasonably described as ratzon. And a response that sort of blinds inner programs without any flexibility at all. Calling it ratzon, it doesn't communicate anything that's useful to know.
No, but a program is a program could be made to figure out under certain circumstances what to do.
Yeah, then maybe indeed, if it had enough flexibility, we might do that. We might indeed do that. I mentioned this to some of you, but for those of you who don't know about it, it's worth knowing. It's an important example. It's an example of what the animal world in a certain sense is like, and also how people are apt to misinterpret, especially academics and scientists are apt to misinterpret. There is a wasp called the digger wasp. What it does is it stings spiders, digs a hole, buries them, and later, when it's hungry, it comes back and digs up the spider and eats it. Pretty clever for a wasp, huh? Preparing for tomorrow. Sort of middle-class deferred gratification. This was actually cited at one time as an example of intelligence in the insect world. Insects were thought as much too primitive for possessing intelligence. Well, this myth was exploded when some clever and very cruel scientist did the following experiment. As the wasp was digging the hole to bury the spider, the scientist just pulled the spider a short distance away from the hole. The wasp stopped digging the hole, went and got the spider, dragged it up back into the hole, and started to dig again. So the scientist pulled the spider away from the hole. And the wasp stopped digging the hole and went back and got the spider, dragged it up to the hole, started to dig again. The scientist repeated this until the wasp died of hunger. Something's gone wrong, I think. If the wasp is digging a hole to save the spider for a rainy day when it's hungry, so when it gets very hungry now, why doesn't it stop digging the hole and eat the spider? It's got a dead one right there. No, you see, it's hardwired. It can't do that. It's got to dig the hole, put it in, and cover it over. Only then can it dig it up and eat it. That's not intelligence. That's not intelligence. That's a hardwired, dumb program, which works a lot of the time when there aren't nasty experimenters, you know, fooling around with the conditions. It works well enough, but it's not intelligence. Intelligence has to be flexible enough to respond to changes in circumstance. If you're going for a goal, and this way to get to the goal is going to cause disaster, if you're acting with intelligence, you ought to be able to respond. I'm not talking about free will now, to respond to the changes in circumstance. Similarly, there's a fellow at Harvard named Hillary Putnam. Yes, that's a man. And he asked the following question. See, another example of overinterpretation. Do dogs have a concept of meat? Do dogs have a concept of meat? Even I was sucked into this one. Sure, you know, they can tell what meat is. They eat meat. They don't eat sand. They don't eat grass. You know, they can tell it by smell. But, I mean, of course they have a concept of meat. So Putnam then gave the following example. There's an advertisement in your neighborhood for a new branch of Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. And for the first week, they're having half-price sale, you know, 2-inch thick sirloins, you know, the whole thing. And you go and you buy a meal. That's great. Terrific, terrific steak. And you enjoy it very much. 2 weeks later, you read an article in the newspaper that this new branch of Ruth's Chris Steakhouse is being sued for fraud because what they sold was soy. It was very cleverly doctored soy to look like meat, to taste like meat, to smell like meat, to have the texture of meat, to have the resistance of meat, but it's all soy. And those people who patronize it are invited to come and get their money back because they've been cheated. But they didn't get meat, they got soy. Now, asks Putnam, can a dog understand that? Can a dog understand that it ate something which tasted like meat and smelled like meat and felt like meat but wasn't meat? The dog hasn't got the resource to understand that. For the dog, all he's got of meat is the sensory experience. That's all he's got. He's got the taste, the smell, the texture. That's not the concept of meat. What is meat? What's the concept of meat? Something that grows on an animal. Not something that grows in a soy field. The concept he doesn't have. All he has is the ability to respond to the sensory evidence of meat. So this is another example of overinterpretation. We see the behavior of the animal, we think ourselves into the animal's shoes, and we ask, what would it mean to us? By the way, we do the same thing with children, and we do the same thing with fetuses. There's a whole psychological literature of nonsense about what the experience of birth must be. There was a fellow named Le Boyer in the 70s, a French doctor, who was inspired by the psychologist, I'm going to talk about this to a certain extent tonight, psychologist who spoke about the birth trauma. You know what a trauma is? A horribly frightening, disrupting experience that leaves scars for the rest of your life. Birth is a trauma, according to Otto Rank and other of his ilk. Even Freud was somewhat sympathetic to this idea. Birth is a trauma because beforehand, the fetus is in a dark and protected and suspended and temperature regulated condition with food continuously provided. And then it comes out in a world with different temperature and harsh lights and without this being suspended, the force of gravity, everything else. It's got to be terrible, terrible trauma for the fetus. Why? Because the naive, foolish psychologist is thinking himself into that condition and trying to experience secondhand what it will be like and pretending to... But the fetus isn't a mature adult experiencing it. Who knows what capacities the fetus brings to it? Not to mention the fact that there are people who enjoy thrills, or even who enjoy being frightened to death. That's why they pay to go on a roller coaster, or they pay to see horror movies, you know, and they're very happy afterwards. I don't know why they do this. They just do it freely, of their own free will. And indeed, if you ever witnessed a birth, well, you haven't, but maybe someday you will, the baby comes out, Some cry, some don't. Even the ones who cry last for about 30 seconds and then it settles down quite peacefully. Yeah. The shriek for hours. Why did you do this to me? How can I get back? No, that's not. This is not what happens. I was wondering whether this guy Rank ever attended a birth. He sat in his study and fought it up. So when we say that they have ratzon, I would say that means that they can respond flexibly to the circumstances around them. They can take note of changed circumstances and change their behavior appropriately. That has nothing to do with free will. On the other hand, a pebble that falls, or a wasp that just digs, it wouldn't be described as having ratzon at all, because the behavior is much too limited, it's much too rote, much too strictly programmed, and without any flexibility. Okay? All right.